Now, after this, I'm going to ask you some little questions like I've been asking you. It'll take about 10 minutes. But you're not hurried now. You've got plenty of time. You work fast. You see, you think so fast. Yeah. Yeah, long in there. Hester, what did it say?
Another view of Hester.
Another view of Hester. That's about 7 years later, I think it says somewhere in there. Interrupt you and get your attention for just a minute. You only have 3 minutes. Can I talk to you just a minute now? You can finish, you can finish. But if you let me have your attention, if you let me have your attention, please. Let me tell you. Now, if you let me have your attention, if you look at me and quit writing. What I would like most of all on Monday is for you to give some thought to Hester in the light of this same chapter 13. Of Dimmesdale, in the light in particular of this particular chapter, especially what he does at the end of the session, the talking that he does, and then pick out some passage that will take the doctor, what's his name, and let's spend 15 or 20 minutes on them. Now let me talk to you just a minute about Emerson. You see, those things like conformity and society, consistency, property, those things, if you start with that, will lead you off. You have to start with the individual, with what Emerson calls the genius. That is Hester Prynne herself. Now, conformity and society and all those things have something to do with her. But you're thinking basically of Hester Prynne, who has an intuition and first thoughts and a personality. I have a feeling we could work it very nicely if you would read or reread, say, the first between 100 and 150 pages of Moby Dick. And I'll tell you why next time, or when we talk about it, I'll tell you why Moby Dick rather than something else. Now, if you just finish your material there and just put your name on top of it and leave it on here as you leave, I'll come back to that. The part of intuition in divinity.
This is Emerson class, the Scarlet Letter, on the Monday, the 5th of February. And this is the day when I first let loose on Hester Prynne.
And work from your papers last time. Hester learned through her solitude what her soul was really like. Emerson says that a great man is one who, in the midst of the crowd, maintains solitude. Hester certainly did this. She acquired an inner strength that was of far greater value than any she had held previously. She finally learned to listen to her intuition. Now, through the loss of society, she gained insight into herself and found herself. Marilyn? Haley, where are you? Now, that seems to open the subject, but it leaves it there. Suppose that she be allowed to discard her scarlet emblem, so virtuous is she in her dealings with her neighbors. This stage of her is somewhat sad, as as the vitality, the passion for life, which before she seemed to encompass, is no longer there. Physically, even, her luster has gone. There's no longer a radiance in her face, or a shine in her hair. It is as if, at this point, she has succumbed to the burden of her sentence, believing that she truly has sinned.
Now, that's a good master picture.
Is that your final word on that, Susan? I'll just restate what you said. At the beginning, she is passionate and has vitality. Now, a little past the middle of the book, she has lost her vitality and reached a low point. Now, books can't be written like that. This has to be her high point. Outwardly, with her hair pinned back and quiet, and as you say, doing penance to society for what she's done, outwardly, but inwardly, through authority, just by this. You get the picture of her 7 years later that she has been deprived of so much that all those possibilities have potential has not been realized. Yes, this is at the point where she and Arthur work things out. Now let me tell you. Yes. I don't see. This book, I always thought of it as so simple and almost inevitable to read it right. And I don't see that we're even getting close to it. She's not even a Puritan. And Hawthorne even makes it clear to start with, you see, he introduces her in contrast to those Puritan women. Now, what is the trouble? You've got your two viewpoints. You've got your view of prudence and self-reliance, and then you have an Emersonian view of self-reliance. And this is an Emersonian view of self-reliance. It has to be. It has to be. Now, what is it? Now, let's sort of forget what you've got here. I was going through some more of your papers. I've got the passages marked. What is it? What is it that keeps us at arm's length from Hawthorne? Now, what is it? Now, you pick up that one cue. Historically speaking, Hawthorne was a good historian. And his view of what had happened in the 17th century in New England was maybe a little clearer than what the historians said. I mean, he is that much a student of history of New England. Now, Hester is a Shakespearean heroine like, who's in The Merchant of Venice, the woman, Portia. Now, who is Portia? Who is Portia? Portia is one of the great Renaissance women, a noble spirit, a master of language. That Shakespeare picked up the idea of her not so much from her contemporaries as from the Italian Renaissance, from those great mercantile houses. Those great Renaissance princes. That's in the first chapter. That's your first view of Hester as a Renaissance lady, like Portia. Now, why doesn't that come through? Well, I think you're stating it directly now. I think you're facing it directly. It looks actually looks as if Hawthorne is not giving an Emerson in view of self-reliance. It's the reverse of that. That's actually the way it looks. Now let me tell you, in this chapter 13, anyone? Yes. Well, now you have to consider that he's not talking abstractly as Emerson did. It's a real person. But we, as a reader, still have to think of her. We have to translate that into Emersonian terms.
But that's where the difficulty comes in.
We have to translate Thoreau into Emersonian terms. I got a little bit at this passage that I've just been reading it from chapter 13. Now look at her relation to these poor that she helped. I'll make a statement on that. Her relation to these poor that she helped. Particular of that. And the thing of it is, and this is now it looks as if Hawthorne takes the other side of it. That he thinks well of Hester because she does that. But we are prepared from Hawthorne and Emerson to be critical of that. Now, so unless you look closely, this is going against them. It's not Emersonian. That's what Emerson says. That's right. He says, don't go 1,000 miles off and do it, but be good to your woodchopper.
And she couldn't hope to gain anything by it. It didn't say anywhere in the book that she helped to.
Yeah.
It didn't want you to believe, and she was doing it because she wanted to.
What's in my mind is now her attitude, her relation to society. You say she's accepted by society.
Well, just, I mean, her doing
it. Yes, I think yes.
I don't think it was to be accepted by society. I think it was to help the way she felt.
To help the way she felt, yes. Stan, I got your paper down here. You look at these things. Now, what is a relation to society? What about society? Sure. Now, your reasoning is straight, except basically I don't think it's still Emersonian. I don't think it's still on the track. So your reasoning is still hasn't got you into the book. I don't think she's accepted by society. Society may not criticize anymore, no, but she still is way off from society. She's never even close to society in this book.
There's a point of acceptance.
You have got to face this problem. You've got to face this question. You see, her power comes to her. Now you can say, thinking in terms of the plot, that it's from holding Arthur Dimmesdale in her arms and planning ahead that gives her power. But that is not Emersonian, and that's not Hawthorne. That's just low-class movies. That's not even good Freud. And read that on these papers. This whole book adds up to the fact they hold each other in their arms and she gets power to confront the man that intimidated her to start with. Now, where is the mentality of the University of Florida? Like we're bandying these terms. We cannot cut through. Now, she was isolated 7 years, she suffered torment, and she cut through. But we have not been isolated. We are in the lap of society, and we cannot cut through. And all Emerson's words are lost on us. And I have given you 5 weeks in which to approach this. And you cannot approach it unaided. You have to have me or some other critic to help you do it. Now, what good is this university and all your public school training when you take a little thin novel like this, one of the classics, one of the great books in American literature, and just basically misread it and seemingly use your mentality on trivialities? I'm going into the insurance business. I have misread books all my life. I misread Conrad. I couldn't read Conrad. I thought I read him. And then I'd see these scholars around the campus, and I said, I wish you'd give me just a little help on this. I know I'm not getting through. Oh, he says, read, Gerard or somebody. He says, he'll help you. The man couldn't spend 5 minutes with me to tell me, kind of give me a lift, give me an insight, just give me a little help into the Conrad. I got a view of Conrad. I got it through an article by Gerard. And the way I got it was one of these so-called critical editions that have the, you know, these critical articles printed along with the text. But you see, the bibliography of all the major writers nowadays is so large, it's just formidable. I'd go through it and I wouldn't know which was which. I'd get lost. Now that's what you run across. I'll lay it out for you. I'll give you 3 or 4 points to consider if you'll write them down. The first one is the one I mentioned in connection with what Ms. Day said, that Hester is not a Puritan. And that first view of Hester ought to speak unmistakably and eloquently of the fact, as Matthew Arnold said, there's so much difference between the Puritan mind and the old Shakespearean mind, that if Shakespeare was on the Mayflower with them coming over here, the Puritans would appear so drab, their mentality is so flat. Now he said that. Portia in The Merchant of Venice. You get that marvelous picture of the Renaissance lady. Marvelous picture. Of course, there's always a possibility that we'll make a 20th century gal out of a Renaissance lady. Now look at this other part, the part we talked about here, the climax, the high point of the story. Well, you have a choice now of the source of her power. One is, you see, that she has met Dimmesdale and they have had the meeting of minds. The other is this, and let me read this to you. A number of you mentioned this, and you weren't quite able to take hold of it and make a go of it. Let me read you a little of this. The effect of the symbol, or rather of the position with respect to society, on the mind of Hester herself was powerful and peculiar. All the light and graceful foliage of her character had been withered up. You can't make it stronger by this red-hot brand. and had long ago fallen away. You don't even have Hester there anymore doing those acts of mercy. Leaving a bare and harsh outline, which might have been repulsive, had she possessed friends or companions to be repelled. Even the attractiveness of her person had undergone this same change. It might be owing to the studied austerity of her dress and partly to the lack of demonstration in her manners, but it was a sad transformation. When you read that, where's your mind? Don't words mean anything? It was a sad transformation that her rich and luxuriant hair had either been cut off or was completely hidden under the cap. And not a shining lock of it ever gushed once into the sunshine. But now look. This is the source of her power. Arthur Dimmesdale has nothing to do with it. It was due in part to all these causes, but still more to something else, that there seemed to be no longer anything in Hester's face for love to dwell upon. Nothing in Hester's form, though majestic and statue-like, that passion would ever dream of clasping in its embrace. Some attribute had departed. Now, much of the marble coolness of Hester's impression was to be attributed to the circumstance her life had turned, in a large measure, from passion and feeling to thought. If you can get a greater transformation, I don't know how you do it. From passion and feeling to thought. And thought seems to be the one element absent in American life. I see it nowhere. Very little in the universities. And hardly any outside. How can we read Hester Prynne? How would we recognize thought when we see it? Standing alone in the world, alone as to any dependence on society, alone and hopeless of retrieving her position, she cast away the fragments of a broken chain. The world's law was no law for her mind. But the world's law is the only law we have in our mind. It was an age in which the human intellect, newly emancipated, this is the age of Descartes, you see, of Newton. You have a brand new outlook on the world. And he said here, of all the people in New England, she was about the only one who had that vision. Her spirit was so freed from society that her mind would work and she could make contact with the great spirits of the age, Descartes and Newton. It was an age in which the human intellect had taken, newly emancipated, had taken a more active and wider range than for many centuries before. Men of the sword had overthrown nobles and kings. Men bolder than these had overthrown and rearranged, not actually but within sphere theory, which was their most real goal, the whole system of ancient prejudice wherewith was linked much of ancient principle. Hester Prynne imbibed this spirit. She assumed a freedom of speculation, of thought, then common enough on the other side of the Atlantic, but which our forefathers, had they known it, would have held to be a deadlier crime than that stigmatized with a scarlet letter. And now all the church groups I've seen find it much easier to reconcile themselves to the scarlet letters than they do any aberrations in thought. Much easier. Any groups. And you see, same thing applies here. Our whole attention has been focused on that scarlet letter, and none at all on her mind. None at all. And what Emerson, the whole basis of his thought is, how can the individual be emancipated from this whole of society on his thought and emotions and attitudes? That's the whole point of Emerson. This, in a way, is Hawthorne's reply, working out response to that Emersonian thought. How can the individual be freed from society? And it's a very hard thing. It's remarkable. In her lonesome cottage by the seashore, thoughts visited her such as no one else dared to entertain. Now, what I say to you, I didn't plan to get off on that. What I say to you is, never in this reading, this term, all of it is embodies this idea. If we can get into it. Now, what kind of Hester Prynne do you see now? What sort of Emerson do you see? What sort of Thoreau? You see, what 99 out of 100 students want in literature courses is someone to come in and talk to them about small matters and give them the birth dates and things of John Steinbeck and what his novels are about, the themes and all like that, what they're about. Now, that's what's in demand. Now, I think, you see, I'm kind of trained up on you. I've let you catch the ball. I've given you plenty of time to do the reading. You've got two contrasting points of view that ought to help you get into one of these things, and you didn't do it. I think that ought to be worth something to you. All this other reading that you're doing, but you see the application. Now, what are the basic points? I ask you to write these down. Start with, she's not a Puritan. In the second place, it's not that reappearance with Arthur Dimmesdale that makes the difference. It is this high point. This is the high point of her emancipation from society that does it. That is what gives her strength to help Arthur Dimmesdale, I'd say. Instead of the reverse, Arthur Dimmesdale giving her strength to face society. No, I don't think that's right. Now, while we're talking about it, and I've been working it out with you, what occurs to you, another point or two that will help you see what Emerson's doing, what Hawthorne's doing. She never has any penance. She suffers. You remember how she suffers? I think that worked out in the second view of Hester. She suffers. No one has dwelled on her suffering. It's all her acts of mercy, and there are only two paragraphs in the whole novel on that, and they are not what you make them, because she never identifies herself with society. even her acts of mercy, is she's still a part. She's still clear part, you see. So what Emerson and Thoreau says, don't apply to her at all. No penance? No penance? Now look, I don't mind giving you cues. You see, I picked some of these things up from I didn't work this all out by myself. I've had a good deal of help. If I just gave you a little longer, you'd get into it yourself. You see, we don't have that much time. Now look, you don't have to go along with exactly what I said. But what I said to you is you can work on that basis. We can't leave Dimmesdale. What is the source of his weakness? That is also on a study, an Emersonian study. Now, next time, let's look at it briefly and see. You look at it, and let's talk about it. And we ought to do something about Chillingworth. The three of them. We oughtn't to let them go. Now, you see, what I'd like for you to do, if you didn't have anything else to do, I'd like for you to pick up these suggestions that I'm passing on to you, not from my own reading, but it's discussing it actually with people like you. Because once you get into it now, you can go ahead. Doesn't it make you feel sort of shabby not to see these big things? Well, you can make up for it. You can pick it up from here. You see these little nonconformities we all make so much of? It just puts them in such a shabby light, you see. That's why I like for you all to be here. Sometimes we say things in here, and a lot of times we don't. But I like for you to be in class all the time. And I hope all of you will come unless you're sick. I believe most of you will. And you have to do the reading and keep it up. Now look, let me tell you. I'll give you a little reading test on Melville this weekend, this Friday, just in order to encourage you to do it. Now look, if you've already done that reading, what we said this morning about Hester will put that in an entirely different light. It won't look the same at all. Now, I've talked too much. It's time to go, isn't it? We are getting into the meat now of the reading. And last time, there were five absences out of between 35 and 40 members. That's too much. And that has been the rule more than the exception. And I think this is some of the finest reading I've ever done. And I just want you here. I want you to take part in it. I want you to be here. I don't think you do very much when you're not here. I trust you. Let me. Yesterday, Wednesday, Monday. Let me see. About Hester in particular. I'd love to hear you talk a little bit about Hester. Now, you see, you've misfired on Hester, on Hawthorne. Now, why? I wish you'd explain it to me. Tell me why we are so far off in some of our readings. Our misreadings are so great. You see, last time I told you that it had taken me, I had done the same thing. I'd love to hear you talk about that just a little bit. Yes.
Just because
it wasn't conditioned by movies and television. I missed it. I can't be, I'm not representative, you understand. I don't mean I'm a model reader. You understand that? I mean, in his time. Now, you raise a question I'm not sure of. Well, you know, so many people would be in tune with this then, you see. They were, you know who Whitman dedicated his first poem to? Emerson. This long foreground. Emerson had written him this letter, or did write him at that time. Well, we'll get into that. So you would have that talk, you know, if you do feel right closely what she goes through. But you've got this in every novel you read. Every piece of literature, so to speak, you know, strictly speaking, literature. You've got this same thing. You've got to disengage yourself in order to understand it. Know what it says. I don't think there's an exception. Not in my experience. From day to day. I told you about Conrad, didn't I? Huh? I told you my experience with Conrad last time. What? Didn't I tell you about that? Yes. I knew there's something wrong with my reading of Conrad. He just couldn't say what I thought he said. And nobody would help me. And I finally found this article. I think a person knows when he strikes true approach. Go ahead, talk some more. More than the most has been said this morning. Not that it's any better than the other, but I appreciate that more. And I'll tell you why. I think that is just inevitable. What we do is respond to the plot. Now, somehow or other, we've got to shake the thought out of the story. Somehow or other. Religion, you know, in the form of religion I was brought up in, you see, in the Christian side of it, you've got the three last days of Jesus. And it becomes inflexible. It's almost the whole base of religion, almost reduced belief in the plot, the action of the last 3 days. You see the suffering and the crucifixion and the resurrection. It's the same thing. Now, when I say things like that, you just ignore them, because by extension. Now, I don't know the remedy for that. What I'll do, I'd like to read a half a dozen books with you, just right straight. I told you I had to see this play that the Florida Players are performing, terrible play with the absurd in it. Marasad. I'm seeing that with a freshman. And I've also got hold of a little text of it, you know. And I can read the text a little better than I can see the play. Then you don't get so much of that extraordinary business. Now, what I'd like to do, if you could, I'd love for you to go over and see that, too. We'd have a chance to read that together. I mean, talk about it. That'd be another little story we could read together. You say, don't we have enough in this course? Yes, but you go to the movie all the time. You spend no telling how much time you spend at the movies. Well, just go see the Florida Players, and take some more time. Cost you a quarter. Students get in for a quarter. And you got a whole week to choose from. That's next week, Valentine's week. That's when the robins are due back up the country where I came from. If the wind blows strong enough. And that'd be an extra good piece. Extra good piece. You know what that is? It's a debate. Basically, it's an intellectual debate. But you never believe it from seeing the performance. Between the two men, one man believes in revolution, and the other man doesn't believe in anything. And it's a working out, a dramatic working out of that. And you see, we could, it's got that much content, just downright straightforward content. Now, so has this. The thing of it is to get rid of it. Now, I ask you today to look at Dimmesdale. Now, you have the same problem looking at Dimmesdale you do at Hester. You get involved in all this rigmarole. And it's almost a matter of picking out the passages. Now, in chapter 13, you see, there's one paragraph on Hester's good works. You know that? And on one of the earlier paragraphs, chapters, there's one paragraph on her good works. There are two paragraphs in the whole novel on her good works. And that's a book of your impressions. Even with Emerson to guide you, who tells you that those good works are bad. Now, when I say bad, see, I'm overstating it. I'm not refining on my thought, on his thought. What it is. We all have the same problem. Yes. Yeah, that's true. Well, anyhow, we're sort of getting into it. Now, I'd love to turn you loose. What's the best passage on Dimmesdale you find? I want to read you something while you are picking out one. This is an old anthology. Represented himself as sort of slow pokey. I don't know how much that was done in the before, but in our time, the writers don't want to represent themselves at all. They want to stay clear of the picture. Hemingway was a pretty vigorous man, you see, and he got into the picture a little bit too much. O'Neill, as I remember, never even had interviews. Even on those long, successful runs of his plays, they never brought him in. He wouldn't go in. And Hawthorne made a basic mistake. He made a serious mistake. Now you say, I say he made a mistake. Well, I think it'll be clear to you what's happened. He says here. After graduation, Hawthorne returned to his mother's house in Salem to live there in comparative seclusion for 12 years. He did that after he graduated from college. He had this period of incubation. He later thought of himself as having been under the spell of enchantment. In a famous letter to Longfellow in 1837, he said, "By some witchcraft or other, I have been carried apart from the main current of life and find it impossible to get back again." Now, what effect does that have on any reader? You read a Scarlet Letter as something clear, away from the main track. If it is away from the main track, you see, you don't want to read it. And it's not away from the main track. And in the Moses from the Old Manse, he says, if these stories, he represents himself, have been brought up, you see, in this old manse of several generations of Puritans before him, go clear on back, you see, to... or somebody in the witch persecution, you know that story. If these stories, as the author later said, have been the, this is Hawthorne's phrase, are the pale tint of flowers that blossomed in too retired a shade. Now there's, I saw yesterday down at country there where I live, I called on one of my neighbors and the shrubs have grown up around the house. They haven't got a gardener, and there's no man around the house. And underneath these shrubs, I saw this azalea blooming, just protected from the frost. But the flowers are pale. That's what he says here. In the protection of this old manse, or in the tradition of the old parsonage, you see, his stories have no life in them. Now, with that approach to Hester, look where you are. He just throws you off. And then you read that custom house thing. And that's one of the worst things ever written. It's sour. It's a disappointed office seeker. And that'll necessarily carry over into this thing here. Now, I'm going to tell you, a masterpiece or something except for the fool, he's dull, has to explode. As you read it, it has to explode. Now that's just a test. It just has to do it. Yes, in chapter 20, the minister to me is. That's one of the good passages on Dimmesdale. Now, when you say how far he has gone, I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. What's that? Reached home, his inner man gave him other evidences of a revolution in the sphere of thought and feeling. Is that what you mean? In truth, nothing short of a total change of dynasty and moral code in that interior kingdom was adequate to account for the impulses now communicated to the unfortunate and startled minister. At every step, he was incited to do something strange. Do you remember that now? Wild and wicked. Yes, and he wanted to pick up his parishioners, and he saw them, and not talk to them like the minister, but, you know, you remember these foolish things he wanted to say? Now, what's come over him? Yes. That's a good passage if we figured out now just what's come over him. Is that the only time you see it? That's the advantage of reading more than one story. The same thing happens in the House of Seven Gables, except there it's more sustained. And Clifford, I think the man's name is, you know, who lives in the attics along in the old House of Seven Gables. And then on the death of the old man Pynchon, I forget the names right offhand, and the Colonel Pynchon is sitting dead of apoplexy in the parlor, and Clifford and Phoebe leave the house and flee, and they get on Thoreau's train and just ride to the end of the line. And he goes out of his seclusion and talks to everybody he sees in this same sort of spirit. You see, if you can kind of put the two together, then you kind of see what Hawthorne's doing. He's got what gets in him to make him do that. That's the thing. That's the thing. So their session, their talk, yes. It comes after that talk, as I remember. Yes. Elation, exhilaration, what's the word? Now you say it's sort of like taking off the mask and being more like himself, and it's you say perversion. But at least he's in a state. What? I don't know what that means. Elated.
Yeah, and nothing matters really. You can just say what you want.
Yes, he's forgotten his taboos, his inhibitions, yes. Well, in my mind, that's exhilaration. But we differ on it. You see, it impressed you one way, impressed me the other. I may read it in the light of the House of Seven Gables, because there it is not depressing. It is exhilarating. And I read that into this. And I think actually that's this way to read that, this passage, because of what it leads to. You know what it leads to? The procession. And he steps gaily on during the procession, doesn't he? And then the election day sermon.
I see.
You're not making contact with Dimmesdale. Now, let me see. What are you doing? I don't think that's right. Now, let's see what you're doing. What are you doing?
No, that has to be a fine. That has to be sort of a flowering of his spirit. The election sermon has to be a flowering of his spirit. It has to be a sort of expression of the high spirit of the 19th century. It has to be a sort of flowering of Emerson's spirit. It's an embodiment of Emerson's thought. It's an embodiment of his thought. You see Emerson's thought worked out in the person of Dimmesdale. That has to be that. Now, you see, that's where I have the advantage on you. I mean, I've read more than you have. You are undoubtedly a better reader than I am. But I just have a little more experience. Now, I know what you have to expect. It's like I used to work mathematics problems. I used to work the answer and then try to get the answer. Well, now that's answer. Can you get the answer? Yes. Crazy? Exhilarated. It has to be flowering of the spirit. But you have something, you see, you've forgotten Emerson entirely. You have just lost count of Emerson. You can't keep Emerson in your mind. I don't know, you just can't keep Emerson. He's crazy, as you say, and I'm putting it down here. He's crazy. If he were exhilarating, as I said, why wouldn't he retain it? But he falls apart, you have in mind. Yes, yes. So it's a temporary exhilaration. He's free of something. Caught up again by that something. Now you've got a standard answer from Emerson of what he's freed from and what he's caught up by. Just one little word, 7 letters, is all you need to answer almost every question. Last time, yes. Why can't you look at Hawthorne through Hawthorne instead of Sir Emerson? I thought maybe Emerson would help you in Hawthorne. Keep you from floundering as you are doing. To say that in order to find oneself, a person has to lose himself. Now, I don't get his thought from those words. To me, that sounds more like the medieval monastic doctrine of self-abnegation. To work out your own thoughts. I'm not telling you anything. Now, somebody else talk a little bit. You haven't talked, Francis. You are, yes. Yeah. Now, that's, what chapter is that? Till chapter 20. That, now, I say it again. Now, he is freed from what he once called sin.
Well, he has committed what he considers sin. He has allowed himself to go against what he normally would do.
He has allowed himself to commit a sin and go against what he would normally do. Yes.
And by doing this temporarily, all of his...
He feels freedom.
He feels freed from his bond to being, you know, the good minister. He's allowed his inner impulses to come out.
Yes.
At times he does the wicked things within him that he's never dared to do before.
But then his bond as minister comes back to him. Account for his sermon. Now, before he does something that frees him from his bond as a minister, he preaches the best sermon. Hawthorne, now let me tell you. You remember, let me see if I can find that. I want you to look at that.
That's, this passage, what Hawthorne is doing is accounting for the great spirit shown in Dimmesdale's sermon. While thus suffering under bodily disease, that's about the third page in that chapter, and gnawed and tortured by some black trouble of the soul, he had achieved a brilliant popularity. He won it in great part by his sorrows. His intellectual gifts, his moral perceptions, his power of experiencing and communicating emotion were kept in a state of preternatural activity by the prick and anguish of daily life. He keeps the wound raw. Now that statement means nothing to you? Now there, you know, to me, as I think back at it, there is what we think of these days as a source of artistic life. There is an imbalance which keeps the senses alert so that one can't be comfortable and sink. His fame, though still on its upward slope, already overshadowed the soberer reputations of his fellow clergymen. Eminent though they were, there were scholars among them. And you see, it mentions, you see, that's true of the old 17th century learned men in the ministry. That represents it correctly. Steadier texture of mind. There were others again, saintly, you see, whose faculties had been elaborated by weary toil among their books, and etherealized, moreover, by spiritual communications with the better world. But none of them spoke with what? Look down that passage. I ask you to study this and bring your books on this today. You don't follow my directions very well. But none of them spoke with what? Look at your book. With tongues of flame. And you have heard that before, where Emerson talks about books. A good book must set the heart of youth on fire. Now here's Emerson's view of books embodied. So, Marilyn, now, how does that work in your, what you said? I said to you, Hester never for that deal. But now he did. The 12, the minister's vigil. Also, partly, was for his kind of hypocrisy, where he was living this the hypocrisy and not doing what Hester did. So that ate on him. Yeah. But she didn't feel that, and remorse. That is, she's not represented as feeling. Now, why wouldn't she feel it, and why does he? You see, there's one little statement in this that would help you tremendously, and it's so simple, just so simple. Yes. Any of them, Emerson or Hawthorne, either makes so very much of a conscience. He, society expects, he knows what he's expected to be. He knows how they look on him. Have you had that experience? I had experience in Sunday school all the time. I have a feeling that it's not open, actually open discussion. They expect me to say something. I have to say kind of what I think they expect me to say. Don't you? I wouldn't say just in Sunday school. You see, even in EH 271, in order to give you what I think Emerson says, I have to go against the whole tradition of the literature courses in the university. And sometimes I'm pinched. I've had a whole, I not only do that in this class, I do it in other classes. And I've had the whole class on me. I've had them on me all up the line, the department heads up to the dean. So far, the president's not taking cognizance. B, that you can look at yourselves in two ways. Theoretically, I don't think you actually have come to grips with Emerson. The one thing in this you see that he is showing is that Hester gains power when she is emancipated from society. And in Dimmesdale, he's showing that intellectually he gets a sort of brilliance, but he never gets the moral power because he's never emancipated from society. It's always hanging over him. Now, I'd say two things. I asked you to diagnose it a while ago. I'll diagnose it now. I think theoretically you're not carrying Emerson over. I don't believe you've quite come to grips with Emerson. And I don't think you've had the experience in clashing with society to know the great power of society, knock people's heads together. Unless you've had your head pretty badly bruised, I don't think you actually feel the power. Now that was the end of the tape. And what I ask him is, now what have we been doing to Hester and to Dimmesdale? We have transformed Hester from a sort of a flat Puritan woman to something akin to Portia and those great ladies of the Renaissance. And Dimmesdale, instead of being a crotchety, dyspeptic, Puritan divine, into someone who has that fire in his spirit and an embodiment, you see, of that genius that Emerson talks about. Now that is the little point I ask you about on the test. It's the end of the essay, The Signs of the Time. One is the increased interest in the commonplace, and not the far away. Along with that is the interest in a single individual, something that magnifies the individual. Now, you can remember in Thoreau, this is the same thing that enables him to take that poor woodchopper, that ignorant Canadian woodchopper, and make such a delight.